Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March the 29th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, I have a bit of a confession to make, and that is that for most of this year so far, I've been kind of letting this show run on cruise control. We got a lot of good panel discussions in the can, and it's been such fun listening to those that I've kind of shorted myself on Harold's rant and rave time. But the purpose of this show isn't entertainment, it's to push for achieving the 14 words of David Lane through a sovereign white republic here in the Pacific Northwest. And so I'm afraid I need to start in on the heavy stuff again, or at least more of it per show. Now, there are two serious matters that I'd like to address this time around, and both of them present the same problem, in that these are things I need to talk to you about, and probably need to talk to you about on the show, because this is the only way I can reach most of you. But on the other hand, there are those listening to this podcast who are here acting on other agendas with the intent to do harm. And these topics, and what I have to say to you about them, are none of their concern. So what I'm going to have to do is pick and choose my words very, very carefully here. In view of who's listening, I'm going to have to leave a lot unsaid and a lot implied, and you're going to have a lot of reading between the lines to do. And even so, this is probably still going to get me into a lot of trouble because a lot of what I say here will probably be deliberately misconstrued by the usual goo-boo goat dancing crew. But anyway, we'll get on with it. Now, the first thing I want to discuss with you is an email that I got from a young man named Connor. Dear Mr. Covington, I have a question about party policy. Can those who have had, note the past tense, can those who have had interracial relationships join the Northwest Front if they stop, awaken, and recognize the urgent need to save our race? I've managed to get two other young white people on board for migration, tentatively at least. One is a rare gem. She's a lovely white woman of many qualities, racial awareness among them, and a working brain. The other is her boyfriend, a chum of mine. He's a 6-foot-tall Nord with thick brown hair. He went off to brood after hearing me mention the Northwest Front, talked to his family, listened to the Brandenburg stuff, and told me he was in. He never read the books and never listened to a single episode of Radio Free Northwest. He just heard the Brandenburg lectures and decided this was his kind of party. He's that kind of guy. The girl is a big reader and started her Northwest novels with The Hill of the Ravens, despite my insistence that she begin with the Brigade, for reasons that will soon become obvious. At length, she reached the same passage I did, the one regarding a white woman of 58, a mother of several white children, being turned into death squads by her own son for dating a gook when she was in her late teens or early 20s. Actually, Connor, no, in the novel she wasn't turned into the death squad, she was turned into the law. There's a difference. Anyway, to continue. I feel that if this standpoint was to be taken, then it would mean the sacrifice of thousands of Aryan men and women that have been misled by the information they have been fed without their consent or awareness, and taught that this is acceptable within today's society. I'm not speaking here of those who continue to find themselves in race-mixed relations, or have had children to those not of our kin. but those who at some point realized their error and forbade themselves this behavior, those who now see the world as we do ourselves. Sally spoke of the fact that you didn't care if people had been misled and made mistakes in the past, only if they did so once they joined the party in our homeland. Now, why should this standpoint of welcoming and casting aside past wrongs in life in light of a greater effort not apply to this matter? After all, what greater source of outrage against Zog can you think of than learning that you were brainwashed into betraying your race and shaming your ancestors, learning that you were lied to by these monsters and turned into an instrument of oppression, alienation, and ultimately of genocide against your own people? Now, we can afford to turn away the habitual users of hard narcotics, the paralytic drunks, the mentally unstable, the disinterested or apathetic, the self-interested and predatory, the subversive, the deviant, the insane, and the mindlessly destructive, out-of-control loons. But those who are none of these things, who are in every way committed, and who yet are former victims of miscegenation propaganda, lies in the foe's insidious machinations, who made mistakes they seek to atone for and remedy. Why reject them? Why persecute them if their hearts are true? Okay, there's more along that line, but I think we all get the idea. Okay. This is a problem which has come up on rare occasions since I've been in the movement, although usually it's for things other than outright race mixing, things like drugs and crime of various sorts, so forth and so on. The fact is, though, that as the Northwest Movement grows, and it will, there are going to be thousands of people, especially young white people, wanting to get involved who have skeletons in their closets. Sometimes very nasty skeletons, but who are genuinely repentant and who are motivated in part by a desire to make up for the racial harm they've done. White children are more and more being raised in a completely dysfunctional and unnatural society, and so in some cases, when they become adolescents or even later, they commit dysfunctional and unnatural acts. Because who the hell was there to teach them any different? Not their parents, that's for sure. More and more kids only have one parent, and that one is always too tired from having to work all day to make ends meet to pay any attention to their children when they get home at 6 o'clock every night. They leave their kids to be raised by daycare and the public schools and television and the Xbox. So it's no wonder that they turn out to be either downright white trash, or else just sort of dweebs, slackers, Otto the bus driver types, wandering the scarred landscape in herds like sheep or dairy cattle, waiting for somebody to come and shear them or milk them. But there is still some good genetic material out there, and not all white boys and girls are Beavis and Butthead or Clueless Valley girls. And so, yes, some of them sometimes experience exactly the kind of spiritual metamorphosis that we want them to experience, even if they do it on their own. They experience a racial awakening, with or without our help, and then they realize what they've done in their past and the enormity of it. I generally take a lenient view of most of the usual teenage faux pas, non-sexual indiscretions of various kinds, if they can convince me that they've really awakened and they're deep-sixing their whole past behavior pattern. Because if a white kid can experience a racial awakening and become enthusiastic about dedicating their lives to the 14 words, usually that means that they were never truly completely lost or their minds completely under control to begin with, and some residual instinct kept them from going over the line into full-fledged miscegenation or buggery. A lot of it is also frankly bullshit. Teenage kids love to shock their parents. For example, a friend of mine had a teenage daughter who nearly caused a double heart attack when she announced at the dinner table one night that she was bisexual. I think she was about 16 at the time. Anyway, my friend didn't lose his head, but he engaged her in a discussion on the subject, and he found out that this girl didn't even know what the word meant, and she almost puked when he told her in words of one syllable just what it is that lesbians do. She was just being silly to shock her parents, and she'd heard this word around, and if some dyke had ever really tried to put the moves on her, she wouldn't have known what was going on, and she would have been horrified if she did. A lot of white kids these days have been raised on Porky's flicks, and they have a lot of Animal House-type crap in their past, if you'll pardon my mixed Hollywood references. There's a lot of drunkenness, a lot of weed, maybe some petty crime or the mailbox-smashing variety, maybe even some real crime with a juvenile or adult criminal record, so forth and so on. Now, there's a lot of attitude problems. I mean, I can't blame any white kid for having a problem with authority when you look at who and what the authority in this country is these days. But getting back to the subject of the email, I have to concede that more and more I do get internet contacts from or about young kids who want to get involved, who've read my novels and want to help found the NVA one day, who want to come here as settlers, and yet who do, in fact, have some kind of sexual problem in their past, which, again, is saddening but not surprising, considering the fact that they were raised in this horrible time and place, and considering that they've been bombarded with images and information on sex since they could turn on a television set. I remember at the time of the Bill Clinton-Monica Lewinsky thing, there was some discussion of having Sesame Street do a special segment on fellatio so that young kids would know what the grown-ups were talking about. They'd probably have Bert and Ernie do it. No, I'm not making that up. It never got past the discussion stage. That was a bit too much even for 1998, although I suspect nowadays it would probably happen. Usually, it's a teenage relationship with an Asian or a Mexican, especially if the gook or beaner is Americanized and speaks with a standard American TV accent, so forth and so on. Because white kids who are raised in a society with no racial standards at all, not to mention all kinds of images of race mixing on various electronic screens, are taught to believe that these are just white people with a tan. Niggers are usually a bit too obviously different for that to fly, not just the physical appearance and the smell and the pants hanging down to their butt crack, but the ebonics and the so-called cultural aspects. Now, the reason that most white girls in high school go with hip-hop niggers is simple. Blacks always have the best drugs, and it would be very unlikely for any white girl who was that far gone later on to experience any kind of racial awakening. But what do we do about this potential problem situation when it does occur? Okay, first off, Connor and everybody, one thing I apparently haven't made clear, so let's give this another shot. There is no such thing as membership in the Northwest Front. It's not an organization. It's not something you join. It's simply a name that we have for ourselves for what you might call the Covington and Northwest Novel branch of the Northwest Imperative. That's because we have to call ourselves something, and Seattle Beer and Skittles Society doesn't quite cut it. No one is a member of the Northwest Front, including me. Now, there are several reasons for this, and one of those reasons is that we don't want formal membership because there are some people floating in and out of our movement whom we frankly don't want as members because we might have to distance ourselves from them in a hurry when they show their butts. The John Hinckley incident springs to mind. I'm also thinking of one particular recent case where a certain lady announced to a world that she seemed to feel was waiting with bated breath that she had resigned from the Northwest Front. No, she hadn't, because she had never been a quote-unquote member. You can't resign from something you never joined and which doesn't exist anyway. So, it's not like your friends are going to be banned from joining Connor. I mean, there's nothing to join. Being down with the NF is a thing of the mind. There's no membership card, and there's no secret decoder ring. Now, if your two friends like the Northwest Novels, and they've been inspired to come here to the homeland and devote their lives to the 14 words, more power to them. I presume that their inspired devotion to their folk will preclude any repetition of the behavior you refer to. But that's not really the answer you're after, I know. What you want to know about is their direct participation in my end of our little revolution here, possibly even eventually becoming a Northwest volunteer. Okay, first off, this is going to sound like I'm dodging the question, but I honestly would have to know more precise details, and it would help if I got it from the person involved, himself or herself. I noticed you didn't even say which one of them had allegedly race-mixed. I don't think I'm trying to shrug this off. Racial defilement of this kind is very serious, and it's not just a youthful peccadillo like stealing a car or getting drunk and throwing up on mom's brand new carpet. Now, I know that this is a problem that we're going to be getting more and more, and we're eventually going to have to develop a protocol to deal with it. Now, here is where we get into the part of the discussion which I believe needs to be conducted out of earshot of certain people who are listening to this podcast with the objective of doing harm and depriving us of our civil rights. And there most certainly are such people listening. Generally speaking, my view is that we will have to deal with each case on an individual basis, and we will have to do a balancing act. The potential good that an individual can contribute versus the potential damage of compromising our principles to any extent at all. All of this, of course, will depend on this person convincing us that they really have changed and it isn't just a phase or they're not motivated by some strange ulterior reason, whatever. There are a lot of variables that are going to come into play in these situations. Yes, I know that sounds cynical and opportunistic and self-serving, but you also have to bear in mind that, yes, I really am serious about all this. And being a student of history, I know that few revolutions have come to power with completely clean hands. Revolutionary movements that place more emphasis on ideological purity than on practical considerations generally don't succeed. Frankly, that's one of the reasons we haven't succeeded up until now. Now, if this sounds like I'm not giving Connor a direct answer, you're right, I'm not. Because again, I remind you that there are people listening to my voice right now who should not be. And this is none of their concern. Nor am I in any way saying that race mixing is ever, in any way, shape, or form, all right, or excusable, or even understandable. Are we crystal clear on this? Because I know damned well that that's what the goat dancers are going to shriek and howl that I'm saying, and it's not. What I'm saying is that we are living in a real world where the very existence of our race is under threat, and we have to quit screwing around and get on with the mission of beating back our enemies. And I do mean beating them back in the literal sense, and securing the existence of our people in the future for white children. We must fight and win a revolution and seize state power first. Then we start to hash out these details. The threat is real. Our response has to be real, and it has to be now, and we simply no longer have the luxury of picking and choosing all our battles, because the big one is on us now. Connor, send me more specific details. Or better yet, if this person is genuinely repentant and they genuinely want in, then have them get in touch with me personally and talk to me and tell me their story, and we'll take it from there. No guarantees, no promises. It may well be something that I simply can't overlook, but I'm willing to listen. And now here's a spiffy little tune in an incomprehensible Scots dialect.
The Chevalier been by the field did march up the Subray man. Through Drenenter he did stent as fast as he could gay man. While General Cope did taunt and mock with many's a loud hurrah man. And next morn proclaimed the cock, we held another from
man. Lave Keel, as I have tell of Captain Onicolus man. The morning fair and clear the air, loose with every starts man. The guns it bruise, swords it bruise, and the chase map man. On seems craft the birds a chat, got run like down.
The bluff dragoons or blood moons, they fight the rebels are a man, and yet they flee when them they see, and when a fire a gunman, they turn the back, the petty cracks, such terror seized them all, man. Some wiped their cheeks, some fell the breeks, and some for fear did fall, man.
But this beast was a hilarious saw man. To back raid and save the same, the Scots were rebels, all man. If it the hell of east, it's still a bloody taste in meat, man. Like me, brag, a hands with neck, what a mast in me.
That still behave like to a hero bright man. His courage true like him a few that still despise a blight man.
And kicking laws and country's cause, not as bad and common. His life but not his courage fled, will he a breath and drum.
At young Longtree as you may see, he was the metal man. There's many slain lie on the plain that plans for sin still man. Take on the wax and deadly hands, I never saw the likes man. Those times meet, I'll spend their deeds at Bellion Preston Plain.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally, and I just wanted to respond to a couple of emails. First, I'm not going to mention this guy's obviously fake name, but I just need to remind everyone that those of you who are in the area and want to meet with us, we will do a background check, and for that we will need your real name. I like to think we're not complete idiots over here, and we can usually tell when someone is giving us a bogus name, so don't bother. We will check you out and conclude that you obviously have something to hide. An easier way to tell if someone is not worth meeting is if that person specifically requests to meet with me. As far as the movement is concerned, I'm nobody. I haven't been around that long, and I've only been a part of this show for just under a year. If you want to come to the Pacific Northwest or meet with a Seattle area Northwest Front cell, I'll most likely tag along. If you have your one-on-one meeting and can demonstrate your ability not to be a screw-up, you'll probably get invited to our first Saturday gatherings, and I'll be the one falling asleep in a corner with a piece of cheesecake. I'm around. I'll meet you eventually if you have a real interest in being a part of us. If you just want to meet me, you're obviously retarded. Next message. Hey, Sally, can you help American Third Position get on the ballot in Washington State? No, I have too much other stuff to do. But really, even if I had absolutely nothing else going on, I wouldn't help you out because I don't care about you guys. I don't even vote. I haven't voted since I was 21, and that was a very long time ago. It's not that I have the attitude that one person or one small action can't make a difference. I know that the opposite is true. And it's not even that all elections are probably rigged. I don't vote for the same reason that I don't call the police when I have a fight with my kids or have issues with a comrade. That's just not how I solve problems. Voting for the right person or the right policy is the perfect way for passive white people to feel like they accomplished something, rather than look to the Northwest novels for instructions on how to deal with gay marriage or illegal immigrants, we check the box that says we frown on that sort of thing, and then feel good about ourselves. I'm looking at the American Third Position website now, and I see a lot of pro-white stuff that I think people would really go for, because it's not at all scary or violent, and there are no masked NVA types with big guns. The kind of people who would actually pay to become a member of this political party are probably the same kind who think that getting all the women together to plant pretty flowers in the park constitutes racial activism, since, you know, all the women would be white. What is conspicuously absent from the American Third Position site is anything related to the Jew. I have noticed that some white people are becoming more brazen about saying, hey, it's okay to be white, right? They always make sure to throw in a little bit of, but I don't hate other races, I just love my own, and I just want to encourage my children to be proud of their heritage. But even the white people who are finally coming out of their shells and admitting they don't really like affirmative action and illegal Mexicans just can't bring themselves to say they hate Jews and that they wish the Holocaust really had happened. And to be fair, many white people still don't know the Jews are a problem at all. They honestly believe if they were only allowed to have their nonviolent, socially acceptable form of white pride, then everything would be fine. They don't know it was the Jew who introduced the nigger into our world in the first place, the Jew who is behind every push to mandate respect for homosexual behavior, and the Jew who has a real interest in seeing the white race die. Someone once asked me why I hated people just because of their religion. I don't. I totally think all white people should be encouraged to keep practicing whatever stupid things they believe in. I hate Jews because they are subhuman garbage who don't deserve to live. If one were thrown into a pit with 100 niggers, I would feel sorry for the niggers. Religion has nothing to do with it. And the fact that there are white people in the world who think Jews are just a harmless religious group is also the work of the Jew. I maintain the position that bullets and bombs are way more effective than ballots. Maybe the NVA could be called the fourth position or something. The position we will all be forced to take when the third position folks can't seem to change anything with their pretty t-shirts and membership cards. Voting will not accomplish what must be done in order to secure a homeland for white people. I still can't believe that in times of war, when we are facing the extinction of the greatest race on earth, there are people who think everything will be fine if we just check the right box. Voting will not give the kikes their real Holocaust. Voting will not leave scores of niggers swinging from lampposts. Not even a vote for Ron Paul will cause all the illegal Mexicans to spew vomit from their ears as they fall face first on an electric border fence and our soldiers stomp their throats into the mud. Instead of voting against immigration policies, why not show some immigrant piece of trash how you really feel about him? Instead of Prop 88 or Measure 6 Million or whatever else is on the ballot now, why not have Measure or Kill Those Who Screw With the 14 Words? I admit, the NVA isn't for those who want to pay with their credit cards and get a neat little membership kit in the mail with a little card and plaque and official letter from the membership coordinator. All you get is a thank you letter from me or Harold. We do have some t-shirts, if that's what you need. They didn't really look good on me, so I don't wear them. The only thing that looks decent on me is my David Duke in 2012 shirt.
And notice how that ties in. There is a phrase in Judaism for Gentiles called goyim, which means cattle, which is animal, an animal. Thus, that exhibits their attitude toward how they view other people, and that ties right in this, not as a spiritual or higher being. I think Aryans have historically had a respect for life and preservation of animals and plant life and all that, but also these are the people who would criticize us for being haters or supremacists when their own language reflects that they have this ideology within them.
Yeah. Another translation for goyim from the Hebrew is beings or animals without souls. You were talking about regard for life. You look at the environmental movement, save the planet, save the whales, save the redwoods, save the spotted owls, blah, 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 blah. Okay, a lot of those people are hippy-dippy, lefty, weirdo types, granted, but I think it's significant that they're almost all white. It's only the white race, even if in a kind of an attenuated representation, but it's only white people who seem to give a damn about the environment at all. The blacks and the Chinese and the Jews and the Mexicans, none of these people care whether or not the spotted owl continues to exist. None of these people care if the redwoods are still around. None of these people care if their streets are littered with garbage and human feces and whatnot. And if you don't believe that, go down to some of these third world countries. Hell, go down to Mexico and look at their sanitary and their environmental arrangements.
When I was in Iraq, I would see vast fields of trash and people would just rummage through the trash. I'm not talking like junkyards, you know, where you go down to like pull an engine or something like that. I'm talking like football field areas of trash where you throw out your refuse, your household refuse, and they're just going through it as a matter of fact. We would see streets where there's shit everywhere, and the Iraqi was fine with it, apparently fine with it, just like it's everyday thing to just have shit water everywhere in the streets. What's the matter with that? That's no problem. That's the way it's always been. That's the way it'll always be. It's fine. We just live with it.
Yeah. Only white people, Europeans, ever invented things like municipal urban sewers. The first sewers were created in ancient Rome, but only white cities have ever had them. Even these ancient cities in, say, China never had a sewage system, because the idea that you need to actually have some system of disposing of human and animal waste that doesn't involve piling it up in front of your house and making your children wallowing and that sort of stuff. Apparently, that idea is unique to white people. Even the so-called civilized peoples of the Orient, so the Chinese, the ancient Cambodians, the Japanese, etc., etc., don't seem to have this whole basic concept of things like, you know, hygiene, environmental health, and all of these things are totally, completely white concepts.
Yeah, the John Crapper machine was invented by John Crapper, a white man, a plumber.
Well, the ancient Romans had flush toilets. I don't know if you've ever read anything about the ruins of Pompeii. It was incredible. Vesuvius erupted and just actually froze this entire Roman town in time. They are still to this day excavating that city and also a little town called Herculaneum. And they literally, you may have seen pictures of these bodies that were just found frozen in, at the very positions that they died in. And the ash silted over the whole town and just more or less preserved the whole town, mummified. And they found things that indicate that the Romans were 2,000 years ago in many ways up to our own standards. They found things like flush toilets, central heating through radiators, the type that we didn't reinvent until the 19th century. They found advanced metalworking and engineering and architecture that, again, was lost for many centuries and wasn't reinvented until either the Middle Ages or later. There are Roman aqueducts built in the time of Julius Caesar and the various Roman emperors that still, to this day, carry large amounts of water from places like the Apennine Mountains and the lakes and the higher ground down to the city of Rome over 70, 80 miles. They are still working after 2,000 years. The Roman roads that were built in Britain were still functioning and were still being traveled in the time of Queen Elizabeth. But only white people seem capable of creating this type of civilization that lasts. The Egyptians created a civilization, but it became stagnant, and it just sort of didn't go anywhere for 2,000, 3,000 years. They had the pyramids, and that's about it. The Chinese had a civilization. They invented things like paper, printing, gunpowder, but they didn't do anything. They invented gunpowder, and they made firecrackers with it.
A historical record indicates that the Egyptians, up till about 1,500 BC, were white. Red hair, blonde hair, blue or green eyes. In ancient Babylon to about 2000 BC, 1500 BC, the sculptures, the eyes are inlaid with a lapis lazuli, which is a blue semi-precious or a base gem. Obviously, I mean, if you're going to make a statue and inlay its eyes with a blue gem, you'd consider that person to be blue-eyed. So the Egyptians were white. The ancient Babylonians were white. I did some reading this last 6 months or so on cuneiform, and I had always thought growing up that cuneiform was a pretty primitive writing system, but cuneiform is actually a universal language. You can write cuneiform from any language. Like, you could write an English cuneiform that's then translated into Chinese. It's actually pretty ingenious, but this ties into China in the 70s and the 60s found all these white mummies. It's some 1,000 or 2,000 white mummies. They're obviously white. They have very Nordic features, white nasal passages, and the nasal passage is pretty important. It's one of the things anthropologists use to determine somebody's race. The little upright bone that sits inside of your nose actually anchors how far out your nose comes away from your face, and it's a pretty general proportion of 1/4. So if your nose comes out from your face 1 inch, then it's a 1/4 inch anchor inside your nose.
That's how they identified Kennewick Man as being Caucasian. Part of the way they...
Right, was based off of the inner formings of his nose. And these are pretty universal how things operate. I don't know what the word I'm looking for, but they found these 1,000 or these 2,000 mummies in China that are all white. And they're all dated 2,000, 3,000 years old. And I'm kind of meandering here, but I'll tie it all in, or I think I'll tie it all in, that the oldest Chinese writings, what's the word for the Chinese alphabet or the Chinese
characters?
Characters goes back to the I Ching and the Emperor's Yellow Book, and these manuals are 3,000 years old, but it's a totally different language or Chinese character from the current Cantonese or Mandarin or whatever. And some anthropologists believe that it's a bastardized cuneiform. So this is kind of interesting that you have white people lived in the Middle East 4,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. The Egyptians were white. The ancient Sumerians and Akkadians were white people. Then all of a sudden in China, you have a book written in an ancient white language and you find 1,000 white mummies. White people were everywhere. We've created all of the lasting cultures on this earth.
And now I think we'll go from the sublime to the ridiculous. This is Eric Cartman.
What has happened to this place? I don't recognize it anymore. It used to be so fun and special. What is life worth living for? The dream is dead. Our land is gone. There's a hole in my heart. Authority. all these minorities out of my water park. Minorities, Mexicans and Asians, black people. I think I even saw Native Americans. God, I'm asking, please get all of these minorities out of my water park. My water park.
Okay, we've got Comrade Charles Martel here in our backroom studio at Radio Free Northwest again. Charles dropped by and we figured we'd just sit down and have a little natter in front of the mic here. We don't really have anything to talk about. What we usually do in that case is we look at the news and just comment on news articles. Generally, we've got enough insane, ridiculous news in our politically correct society to give us all kinds of material here. By the way, we're making this several days after the death of Andrew Breitbart, the conservative news pundit, and already they're whispering that he might have been knocked off because he had some video proof that Obama hung around with radicals in college, which I think we already knew. Okay. Most of the news, as usual, is about this idiotic Republican primary, which, in my view, is a waste of time because I think Romney's got it. He is a palooka. He is being set up to lose to Obama because of this agreement I've discussed before that I'm sure the parties have, that each one gets 8 years in the White House, and so we won't mess around with that. Okay, let's...
Well, I think that the whole thing is a waste of time anyway, because it's been clearly proven or documented that the you-know-whos control the voting machines. And if you control the voting machines, it doesn't really matter who you vote for, because whoever they want to win will magically win, as they demonstrated with Bush and also, I think, with Obama the first time around. I have a hard time believing that more than half the people in this country actually voted for him, but... Again, if you control the voting machines, as Comrade Stalin says, we really don't care about who votes.
Like Boss Tweed said in the 1870s, well, as long as I control who counts the votes, what are you going to do about it?
There's my hero.
Who? Putin?
Putin.
Apparently the CIA or somebody's trying to overthrow him now. They're trying to create a Russian spring and bring the mobs out in the street, demanding that there be a Starbucks on every corner in Moscow and all this sort of stuff. There we go. Student sues college, says roommate's active sex life drove her to deep depression. We really need Sally here for this one, but let's see what we can come up with.
For sure.
Okay, let's see. Stonehill College student's lawsuit, roommate had disturbingly open sex life. A college student from New York is suing Stonehill College in Massachusetts, a Catholic liberal arts college, saying her roommate's sex life drove her to a suicidal depression and that the school did nothing to address her concerns. Okay, that's weird. The student, Lindsay Blankmeyer, wonder if that's a Jew, well, going to a Catholic college, I don't know, anyway, alleges that her roommate, Laura, was having online and actual sex right in front of her, according to the court complaint. More disturbingly, Laura would have sex with her boyfriend while Lindsay was trying to sleep just a few feet away. Laura would also engage in sexually inappropriate video chatting when Lindsay was in the room. But apparently, I guess just moving out of the room never occurred to her.
Wait. Isn't a liberal Catholic college an oxymoron?
No, it's a Catholic liberal arts college, that is.
Excuse me. Oh, okay.
Right. Blankmeyer suffered from depression and attention deficit disorder when she enrolled at Stonehill in September 2007. In other words, she was already cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. She said she wanted to see how she would perform in a school without any sort of additional help in the form of a reasonable accommodation. And that's one thing I've noticed about these articles. They seem to be illiterate. These people don't know how to write. However, the complaint states that Blankmeyer began to incur issues because her roommate often had overnight guests without asking her permission or even informing her that she would be having guests. The complaint also went on to say that Blankmeyer's roommate would stay up late with the lights on, keeping her awake. The complainant even claims that her roommate began shaking her and yelling at her when she was sleeping. Okay, all of this is worth a lawsuit? Blankmeyer eventually went to her blah, 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 resident assistant detailing her toxic environment and emotionally taxing struggles. Okay, anyway, she's suing the school for all this. Sounds to me like some ambulance-chasing lawyer got a hold of her and figured we'd shake down the Catholics again.
Well, you know, the whole thing's kind of hard to believe, but who knows?
Okay. All right, let's see what else we've got. Couple sues over neighbor's noisy wooden floor. Oh, we got all kinds of lawsuit news here. Okay, let's...
Well, that's because they're cranking out a couple of thousand a day in all the or law schools in this country.
Well, this is in Britain, apparently.
Oh,
well. Dotheads are suing their, I guess, English neighbors. Hamid and Inan Faidi claim that the sound of their neighbor's shoes on the wooden boards constitutes a noise nuisance which has shattered their peace. The couple have taken the landlord of the apartment in Belgravia, West London, which is an extremely upmarket part of London, to court, and blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's just silly. Report. Europeans first to arrive in North America. This ties in with my...
Salutrians,
and also the...
Kennewick Man.
The Kennewick Man and my third half of Freedom Sons. Okay, yeah. My third section of Freedom Sons. When the crew of the Virginia scallop trawler Sinmar hauled a mastodon tusk onto the deck in 1970, another oddity dropped out of the net. A dark, tapered stone blade, nearly 8 inches long and still sharp. 40 years later, this rediscovered prehistoric slasher has reopened the debate on a radical theory about who the first Americans were and how they got here. Okay, rather than sit here and read this whole article, let me just run the whole Salutrian thing down for you. There is an increasing amount of archaeological and historical evidence that the first people on the North American continent were white people. Part of this is because of a certain type of stone, spear, and knife, and arrowhead-type blade, which is in a particular shape which I can't really describe on a radio, but it's called the Salutrian shape because it was found in an area near Salutre in France, and it establishes a definite connection between the peoples of prehistoric Europe and prehistoric North America, because there are other types of spear points and knife points and whatnot that are found in North America that are not Salutrian and which are pretty clearly evidence of Indians or the ancestors of Indians, etc., but they are of a much later date. It says here, archaeologists have long held that North America remained unpopulated until about 15,000 years ago when Siberian people walked or boated into Alaska and then moved down the... This is a long article, but basically it is entirely possible, in fact likely, that white people were here first because they came across the ice. Now, if you ever get a chance to get hold of a video put out by the Discovery Channel called Ice Age Columbus, this details how our ancestors could have gotten here before the Indians. And, of course, then we had right here in the Northwest the Kennewick Man incident. There's a very good video on that called Homicide in Kennewick, which, if you can get a hold of it, please give that a view as well. But what's interesting is not so much that this may have happened, but the effort which the politically correct establishment has been undertaking for the past 20 years or so to try and suppress this evidence.
Actually, they've been trying to suppress it ever since... Oh, what's the guy that sailed down the... Fremont. Ever since Fremont sailed down the Colorado River?
Mm-hmm.
He was the first director of the Smithsonian...
I don't know. There was Fremont was a Western explorer. Yeah. He was also a Civil War general.
Who's the guy that first shot the Colorado had one arm?
I have no idea.
Well, anyway, he went on to become the head of the Smithsonian, and he started the whole idea of isolationism. Before that, everybody believed in diffusionism, which meant that white people had spread out all over the world and that all the old European cultures had interacted with the cultures in Asia and the Americas. And there's tons of evidence for diffusionism, but over the last 100 years, the Smithsonian has been wild about suppressing it for unclear reasons. Their library is full of books written document the fact that the white people were here before the non-whites. In fact, almost every Native Indian tribe in the Americas, especially in the United States, has a legend of the Lenni Lapi, which were white people that lived here before the Red Indians. And the Red Indians started a war of extermination that went on for generations until they finally killed off all of these white people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are legends that almost every Indian tribe will tell you about.
Yeah. Apparently, there were white people here, but there weren't very many of us. And the Indians, I think, basically just ended up outnumbering us. And I think that's kind of a salutary lesson for the future, because if we don't watch it, we're going to be outnumbered again. And apparently, we saw once about 8,000-9,000 years ago what happens when white people get outnumbered on this continent by wogs.
And the other thing is, they've been digging up white mummies in the United States and all of the Americas for hundreds of years. In fact, you can go to a museum in Peru and see the mummies of the Incas, actually the ruling clique of the Inca Empire. All those mummies have red or blonde hair. And then there's the mummies they dug up in Nevada, I think in Spirit Cave.
Spirit Cave, yeah.
Right. The red-headed people and the Paiutes. actually have a very detailed legend of the last battle where they killed the last of the red-headed mm-hmm. people. And then actually the red-headed people retreated into Spirit Cave, and the Paiutes surrounded them, and I think they gassed them to death, actually, by building mm-hmm. fires and letting the smoke mm-hmm. blow into the cave. First Holocaust.
All right. Look at Easter Island. You yeah. may remember the pictures of those narrow-skulled, long-faced, thin-lipped individuals carved in stone on Easter Island. They're all over the island. What you don't see is that originally the statues had painted topknots, which were like separate carved stones that were placed on top of the heads, and it was symbolic of these people's red hair, and these were called the Hanau'ipi, pretty clearly white people. According to Easter Island mythology, they sailed from the east, which would have been South America, which would be a connection to the Inca area there, since Easter Island is actually off the coast of Chile. It's admittedly quite ways off, but still, these white-skinned people allegedly landed on the island. They more or less enslaved the Hanau Momoko, who were the brown Polynesians, and put them to work building these huge stone heads, which, like I say, we now see all over Easter Island. We don't know why. It was obviously some strange religious thing. And eventually, the inevitable happened, and the brown skins revolted. And since there were more of them than there were of the white skins, the white skin people were slaughtered. But these people had, for example, writing. There were, I can't remember now the name of this form of writing, because it's been a long time since I've read Aku Aku.
But actually, you're not going to believe it. I think it's Obongo. Or a Rapongo, something like
Rapongos,
that.
Yeah, something, yeah. Something like that. But
maybe not.
No, they were like, it was like on wooden slates. The sacred writings were kept hidden in caves and this sort of thing. I mean, these were not spacemen or anything like that. These Hanau'ipi were still fairly primitive people. I mean, they had to carve their statues in stone, and they had to write on pieces of wooden bark and whatnot and skin. But the fact is that they had things that the Polynesians never had. For instance, the whole idea of stone carving, which no other Polynesian culture ever did or ever engaged in, and they had a written language, and yet now it's all wiped out. Because, again, the problem with these prehistoric whites seems to have been that always in North America, South America, there were just very, very few of us, and there were a whole hell of a lot of the brown skins.
Right, and they didn't have gunpowder. It's well documented in the Greenland sagas about Leif Erikson and his sister actually coming to the New World to get in the lumber trade. That's one of my favorite stories.
Afraid of the axe murderers? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. She was great. She rented a boat, hired a crew, sailed over to like someplace around Boston or someplace mm-hmm. to cut down trees. Another boat showed up and it was cutting in on her action, so she mm-hmm. just went over with her crew and killed them all.
Yeah, right.
Well, first liberated woman.
Yeah. A lot of people have wondered why the Vikings never actually colonized all of North America, since it's now acknowledged that they were here first, and largely that's it. That was a pretty long way. North America was kind of right at the end of the earth, even for them, but what we had here in North America that they wanted very much was timber, because in Iceland and in Greenland especially, wood was just worth its weight in gold because they don't have any native forests there. So basically the Viking settlements on this continent were lumber colonies, and they would come over for a season during the summer. They would cut as much timber as they could and load on their ships, or maybe float it across back to Greenland in rafts. I don't know how it was done, but the intention of the Vikings was never to settle here permanently. Why they would prefer Greenland or even Iceland to coming to this big new continent, I don't know, but then wasn't a Viking.
Well, during that time period, there was a warm age, and actually the southern part of Greenland was very warm, and they actually could farm for about 300 years, and there was quite a large colony there, and then they basically got froze out by the Little Ice Age. But I'll tell you, there were Vikings wandering around the United States, because a bunch of them made it all the way to Minnesota.
And you're talking about the Kensington Runestone?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. If you're ever there, you should go by the museum, which is very fascinating. They've actually got the runestone and plus a lot of other evidence mm-hmm. that the Vikings were wandering around Minnesota and 1300.
I won't sit here and just read this article out, but what's interesting is that this is from the Washington Post, which is a liberal newspaper, and it seems to be fairly objective. One archaeologist says, "I drank the Salutrian Kool-Aid," said Steve Black, an archaeologist at Texas State University in San Marcos. "I'd been very dubious. It's something a lot of archaeologists have dismissed out of hand. But I came away from the book feeling like it's an extremely credible idea that needs to be taken seriously. Okay. But I think it's a little bit of a different tune from the hysteria that greeted Kennewick Man. It could well be that the system has decided, well, maybe if more and more of this evidence is going to start turning up, maybe we need to somehow accommodate it. I will say this, though. About a year ago, I did a review of a new white nationalist novel. It's called, I think, what, White Apocalypse, mm-hmm. by a young man named Kyle Bristow, and it's all about Solutrians. Now, the novel is, well, I personally found it a little bit thin plot-wise, but I mean, you know, hey, it's this kid's first work, and it was good. It's readable, definitely, and the plot's okay, but the main thesis of White Apocalypse has to do with the Solutrians and the fact that we were here first. Anyway, this kid published this novel online, and the ultra-lefty libs, including Morris Dees, just went berserk. Apparently, my own Northwest novels aren't worthy of notice for whatever reason by somebody like Morris Dees. I don't know why Dees has never even mentioned my books, but he really did get upset about this White Apocalypse book. Apparently, the very suggestion that white people might have been here first and that the Indians might not be the poor, persecuted little victims that Orthodox history has made them out to be and so forth, it could have ramifications even today. I mean, who knows? The government might take their casinos away from them or something.
Or we could open up ours.
Yeah, right.
And sell cigarettes.
Yeah. We'll have to establish a white reservation around Kennewick. We're the descendants of Kennewick Man. We demand the right to establish a casino and set up a tobacco shop.
Really?
No, seriously, that was one of the things that the Indians and their attorneys were griping about at the time of Kennewick Man. Not about the right to know or the right to scientific knowledge or anything like that. One of the objections that the Indians had to this whole proceeding of examining these remains and possibly proving that they were Caucasian was that if it were questioned that the Indians were here first, then their, quote, Native American rights and treaty obligations might be compromised. In other words, literally, they might lose their welfare checks and they might have to obey the salmon fishing laws like everybody else, and they might not have their casinos. So, basically, the Indians stand to lose quite a bit of money if it was proved that we were here first.
Far from home, and they burn. tragedy all in its place. Rank and file ever turning and moving the space on paths of black and gold. They come
okay, I said at the beginning of the podcast today that I had a couple of serious topics that I need to talk about. The first one being this vexed question of where the red lines are. And I can tell you right now, I'm going to get all kinds of static on that one. But there's something else I need to speak about. And although it's a little bit more positive, once again, I have the same problem in that there are things I need to say to you and explain to you here on the show because this is where I can reach the most people. But I also have to bear in mind that there are people listening to me right now who are here solely for the purpose of doing harm, and this topic is none of their business. So once again, some of you folks out there are going to have to listen very carefully, read between the lines, and decide whether or not the shoe fits and whether you want to wear it. No one knows better than me how frustrating and enraging this movement's apparent near total lack of success and progress can become in someone's mind. I know because I've been doing it for 40 years. There is no one anywhere on the white right who is more intent and eager on finding that magical fast forward button that will skip over all the heavy lifting that has to be done and catapult us right into the fun part. Once again, I find myself in the invidious position of sounding like I'm running something or someone down or poo-pooing certain ideas and people, and I'm not, really. I say again and again and again, I get it. I feel deeply your restlessness and your frustration that nothing seems to be moving. I applaud your sense of urgency. These are good things. It shows that you have healthy instincts, and it really disturbs me to have to sound like I'm raining on the parade. Now, we are now at the point where we actually have some people on the ground here in the Northwest who are becoming so frustrated by the apparent lack of forward motion that they're beginning to agitate. Harold, Harold, we gotta do something, Harold! Gotta do something! Gotta do something! Gotta jump up and down and shit snowballs! Gotta do something! Gotta get those TV cameras turned on us because everybody knows if you're not on TV, you're not real! Okay. Cool your jets for a bit, guys, and let me go off on a bit of a Grandpa Simpson ramble here. Now, I personally date the beginning of the post-war white nationalist movement from 1948 when Condé McGinley founded the newspaper Common Sense. So that's 64 years now that we've been at this. And during those 64 years, the one distinguishing hallmark of our movement has been pretty much total failure. Why? Well, I've spent a large part of my career explaining that at some length and in some detail, and that's why a lot of the more prominent figures in our little subculture to this day froth at the mouth and fall down in an epileptic seizure when my name is mentioned. I won't go into all that now, but one of the many reasons why we've failed is an almost total lack of strategy and very poor tactics. Of course, the most obvious failure along this line is our refusal to adopt the one revolutionary method which might actually bring about change, but I've said all that before in the Brandenburg lectures, and so I won't repeat myself. Instead, however, we have adopted tactics from an earlier age, both in this country and in Europe, from the time when mass movements were possible and were sometimes a reality. When the overwhelming majority of the white population, our grandparents and great-grandparents, agreed with us and were not afraid to say so in public. Those were the days when the Klan or the NSDAP in Germany or the German-American Bund or the BUF in Britain could call a public rally and thousands of white people would actually show up. That no longer applies. This is 2012, not 1932. It is true that there are millions of white Americans who would agree with us, in theory, if they knew that we are here. The media blackout is making sure that they don't. Obviously, we have to break that blackout somehow. The problem is that they have the power and they make the rules, and the rule right now seems to be that unless someone is killed or arrested, the Northwest Front doesn't get so much as a whisper of publicity. I repeat, since the NF was officially founded 3.5 years ago, we have received brief mainstream media publicity twice. Once in October of 2009 when Jeff Hughes was murdered, and once in January of 2011 during the Bionic Backpack episode in Spokane. To be sure, I was also approached by a producer from the BBC in London who said that he wanted to feature us on a documentary, but after several discussions with him, it became obvious that he wasn't doing a serious news story, and so I declined. The question is, how do we break that blackout? I've already said that I'm open for suggestions and even for downright publicity stunts, so long as they present the party in a positive light and so long as they have some chance of succeeding in getting us the serious, responsible, and above all, widespread coverage we need to make the white people of the Pacific Northwest learn that we are here and give them some idea of what we stand for. We cannot, dare not devolve back to the bad old days and the bad old ways, wherein we became so desperate for 30 seconds of a sneering soundbite on a purely local 6 o'clock news channel that we ended up making fools of ourselves in public, making ourselves look weak and tiny and contemptible, and also allowing the police and the FBI and the Southern Poverty Law Center to accrue more data about us for their files. Look, guys, I know that even after all these years, it's kind of hard for a lot of you to wrap your minds around the fact that, yes, I really am serious about all this. And yes, I think we need to begin acting like genuine revolutionaries, even if we're not yet. One of the most basic principles of any revolutionary group is that you do your best actually to conceal from the government you're trying to change just who you are and what you're doing. I mean, wow, think of that. Us, white nationalists, actually concealing our identities and concealing what we're doing from the feds. What a concept! Nobody's ever tried that before. No, I'm not joking. Until the Northwest Front came along, nobody's ever tried that before. I wonder if it would work. Well, why don't we find out? Okay, yeah, with all their money and their manpower and their electronic surveillance toys and their databases and the Patriot Act, we probably won't be completely successful, not for a while, until we get more practiced and experienced at what Lenin called the conspiratorial method. But why not, at least let's just give it a shot. Make these bastards work. Now, somebody on our side has got to start taking all this stuff seriously sometime. Why not us? Why not now? Okay, I'm running long again, but for the next few podcasts, I'm going to be talking more on this topic. And if you haven't been able to figure out what the topic is, well, that's kind of deliberate on my part, in view of who's listening. See? There. I'm already doing it. I'm already actually concealing something from the secret police. What a revolutionary idea. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Underban. Freedom.